to me, what a Radiolab story is, it's like a rip-roaring good story that has, you know, twists and turns and suspense and characters and emotional arcs and things like that. But more so than that, it's a story with either an idea or a question hidden inside of it. It's a story that makes you, by the end, don't know quite what to think. You don't know quite know what to feel. When it's at its best, I think it pulls your head in one direction and your heart in the exact opposite direction. I think that it introduces you to a whole new world or a whole new question that you never even thought of. Or it'll make you look at a thing that you thought you knew, you know, a point of view of the world that you thought you had, and it'll make you sort of reconsider it, and it'll make you see it in a whole new light. That's kind of my marching orders as someone who goes out and finds Radiolab stories. Those are the things I'm looking for.
Hey everyone, how's it going? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast, where I interview world-class storytellers about how they craft the stories they tell. This episode is a special one. My guest today is Latif Nasser, the Director of Research at Radiolab. Before I give you some more background on Latif, a quick story about why this is a special episode for me. So Radiolab has been really influential for me. When I was applying to Stanford back in 2009 or so, I had to write an essay about why Stanford was right for me. And in that essay, I wrote about how Stanford's human biology major was perfect for me. Human biology was all about understanding humans from biological, behavioral, and social perspectives, that kind of thing. And the reason that was perfect for me was because there was this show called Radiolab that I was obsessed with, and it dove into similar themes. Freshman year at Stanford, I started taking intro science classes, kind of like the human biology core. And to my surprise, I was not captivated. I was like, what is going on? I was bored. I wasn't seeing or feeling the magic. So I continued to explore different subjects, and I ended up in a creative writing fiction class. And I absolutely loved it. I was obsessed. The stories I was writing and reading in that class were all I could think about. And then it dawned on me, the reason I loved Radiolab and why that was so influential to me was because of the stories, not just because of the science. And that kind of led me down the path of where I am today. And so fast forward 8 years to today, here I am interviewing Latif Nasser, someone who has told some of the most powerful Radiolab stories that I've ever heard. As I mentioned, Latif is the director of research at Radiolab. He's a reporter, producer, all-around story maker there. And his stories are on a range of topics. In 2018, he created stories on everything from life at the southern border to the blue blood of horseshoe crabs to voting laws to hockey. He does it all. In this episode, Latif and I discuss how he went from a theater kid with playwriting aspirations to creating stories for Radiolab, how he chooses which stories to pursue, and then we go deep into the dynamic, collaborative, and very unique process that they use at Radiolab to go from initial pitch to the stories that end up making us laugh and cry when we listen to them on the radio. So let's get into it. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Latif Nasser. All right, Latif, thank you so much for joining me on the Austin Meyer Podcast. It's been a while, and I'm so excited to connect with you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me. It's my honor.
Yeah. So where am I reaching you today?
I'm in my garage. I'm at home in Los Angeles, California.
Okay, so Radiolab is based in New York. From my understanding, you were there for a little bit.
I was there for a long while. I moved to Los Angeles because of my wife. My wife works in the TV industry out here. And so we were for a long time, like, you know, she'd be over here and I'd be over there and we'd fly back and forth. And it was kind of a cross-country farce where we'd be, you know, coming and going all the time. But then we had a baby, and then we were like, okay, we need to pick one of these places and just settle. So now we are here.
Oh, that's amazing. How old is your baby?
He is a year and a half now. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
How's parenthood going?
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's like, it's just, I mean, there are really annoying parts to it, and there are times when it's a real drag, but it's like I have not laughed this hard in years. Like, it's been
really?
A year of straight laughing, and partly it's because of sleep deprivation, but partly it's because of, like, it's just so funny to... I mean, it's so cliche, but like, you're seeing the world from scratch. Like, you have to start all over again from first principles, like explaining and thinking through everything, given everything you know. And it is, yeah, it's a trip. It, like, nothing makes sense. Everything is absurd. Like I'm teaching my kid, like, why should 0 and O be basically the same symbol? It doesn't make any sense. Like, it's so weird. Like, was that a choice? Was that not a choice? Was that an accident? Like, was that, like, who, like, it's weird. It doesn't make any sense, and he just has to know it. But like, it's like, but he's right. Like, it's weird. And we all kind of are inured to that weirdness, but like, it's right there. It's like, everyone could see it, you know, that
yeah,
kind of thing.
I could see, based on the way that I know you think about finding stories, that might open up some interesting, or send you down some interesting rabbit holes, just having to see the world from that perspective, or even explain things to your child in a way that you probably didn't think.
I hope so. So far, we're still on the most rudimentary level, because that's sort of what he understands.
Right.
But even then, like, some of the questions he has are really interesting. But I think, like, soon, I'm really hoping that too. Like, soon, some of the, I'm banking on the questions that he's going to have are going to just, like, just make me curious about whole new things that I've totally written off. Yeah.
So is it a lot different experience working for a radio lab now that you're just not in the office very much?
Yeah, in a way, it's like it's actually it's different. It's different in the sense that like Radiolab, like many other places, it's like because it's a team, which is awesome, and it's like an open concept office, right? So everyone's kind of like jumping all over each other, and they're all gabbing, and so people like will have their headphones on, but then they'll like give you like kind of mean looks, because especially me, like literally when they hired me, the first thing they told me was like, you're gonna need to shut up, like you talk way too loud. And it's an open office over here. But that was like a thing where sort of everybody was in everybody's space, and everyone's looking over everyone's shoulder, and in a really exciting way, where you're like, oh, wow, what's that amazing thing that you're looking at on your computer screen or whatever. But it also meant that you were sort of, I feel like now that I work and live, I work from home, and I work in my garage where I'm like basically by myself talking to myself all day. The amazing thing is I can like really indulge my curiosity. Like if I get interested in a thing, I'll just go off and it'll be a really long time, and no one will be like, hey, you've been looking at that same like website for like 2 hours. Like, what are you doing? I just kind of can go on a jag and just let myself loose. And sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse.
So I'd love to hear a little bit about, like, if you were to say kind of your origin story, where the end of that story is you ending up as the director of research at Radiolab. Like,
sure,
where did
sure.
this, where would you track that to? Where does that start?
Well, so in college, I studied theater. And that's what I really loved. And I hated science. I hated, I just didn't have a mind for it. It was interesting, but I was like, meh, all the science classes I took were just like a drag. And they felt like the labs just felt like drudgery, you know? And so I was a theater kid. I hung out. The thing I really wanted to do more than anything else was write plays. College, the end of college came around, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I applied to a bunch of playwriting grad schools, and they didn't take me. And I just didn't know what to do. And one of the things I did, let me also say another thing that happened while I was in graduate school, I took this one class, and it was I feel like every college has these like rocks for jocks or stars for poets or like these classes that are like clearly science classes for non-science majors to like let them tick off the box. So yeah. I took a class like that. It was an astronomy class.
Okay.
It was like the history of astronomy or something like that. It wasn't the history of astronomy. It was just like astronomy 101 kind of thing. Stars for poets is what they called it. Mm-hmm. And part of my project, or part of my assignment for the final assignment was that there was an option where you could put on a play. And the play was Bertolt Brecht's Life of Galileo. And so I was like, oh, that's awesome. Like, that's what I want to do instead of, you know, some kind of lab or something. And so I did the play. And as part of the play, when I was doing it with a bunch of other theater kids, we needed props. So we like needed props to put on this, you know, science-y play about the life of Galileo. And I had heard these like rumors around campus that there was this room in the basement of the science building where there were just all these old, weird, like scientific instruments that nobody was using. They were just like really old, like dusty, old, unused instruments. And so I managed to figure out who was in charge of that room. I went down there. I could not find that room. And then finally I managed to figure out who was in charge of that room. And it was one of these professors. And I emailed him and I set up a time to go visit him. And then when I did, it was like behind this set of like unmarked double doors. And I walked in and it was this amazing moment where it was like, to me, it very much felt like the Indiana Jones moment where you go in that warehouse and there's like just all this stuff. And you're like, what are all these boxes? Like, what is all this stuff? How is this down here behind unmarked doors?
Yeah.
So it was this moment where I was like, oh, this is so weird and cool. And that, and so it was this collection of historic scientific instruments that this professor, this history of science professor, I didn't even know that was a field. But there's this guy who is a historian of science, and he was in charge of this room with all of this stuff. And so I asked to borrow a bunch of stuff for this play, and he'd let me borrow it. And then I brought it back afterwards. But I kept like going to this room because I was like, what is this weird stuff in this room? And I basically, just in a way for a job and for something fun to do, I became that professor's research assistant, kind of going through all this weird stuff in this history of science instrument collection. And so I was graduating from college. I didn't get into any of these playwriting grad schools. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And I was like, I guess I could study the history of science? Like, I guess, maybe?
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to be a historian of science. I knew I wanted to be like a playwright, but I was like, I guess I don't really have anything to write plays about. Like, I want to be a writer, but I don't know anything. And I don't have anything to write about, really. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to learn the history of science and maybe there will be stories in there. And so I applied to grad school in the history of science. I got in miraculously. I remember the interview I did. It was in Harvard's History of Science program, which is the best history of science program.
Nice.
I went there, and my interview was like it lasted, I would say, maybe 3 minutes. The interview went, do you have a background in history? And I was like, nope. And then the guy was like, this was a Harvard professor. And he goes, do you have a background in science? And I'm like, nope. And then he goes, huh? And then he said, you know, we have two language prerequisites for this program. Do you speak French? And I was like, very, very poorly. And then he's like, do you speak German? And I was like, nope, not at all. And then he was like, okay, thank you very much.
No way.
Yeah, that was my interview for grad school. And then I walked out and I'm like, that was the worst interview anyone could possibly have ever had in the history of interviews.
Right.
And then, I don't know, somehow they let me in. Still a mystery how that happened. But uh, But they, and partly it was because that professor who I had been his research assistant, I think he put in a good word and he had graduated from that department. Okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So I got into history of science grad school, and it was amazing. It was so, so cool. And it was amazing because there were all these stories just everywhere, these amazing stories about scientists. And I realized like part of the reason that I was so turned off to science was that even though I thought it was like so beautiful and interesting and philosophically rich and great things to think about, there weren't any people involved. Like science just felt like this depersonalized thing. It was just like a bunch of, you know, it was a stack of facts, like is what it felt like. And then what I realized was the history of science was so awesome because it was science. It had all the fun of science, but it had people and it had stories. And stories was the thing that was like, oh, that's the like, that's the juicy stuff. That's the stuff that actually hits me where I live. Like it doesn't hit my brain. That actually like hits me in my person, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was in this history of science grad school program, and I was just like learning all these stories. And I'm like, how does nobody know all of these stories? These stories are amazing. I would just learn them all over the place. Like all these books people would just mention or classes people would just, you know, toss off some aside, or there'd be some footnote in some book or some librarian would mention something. And I'd be like, oh man. And it was like every few days I'd like learn a whole new thing. And I'd be like, wow, how do I not know about this? How does the world not know about this? I got so excited about these stories that I was like, okay, I'm gonna write up these stories. Like I'm gonna use my playwriting chops and I'm gonna like tell these stories like they deserve to be told because they are awesome stories. Mm-hmm. And I started submitting them. I didn't really know what to do with them. I started submitting them to journals, like academic journals, and then they kept getting rejected, and I was like, oh, that's a bummer. And I didn't know what to do with them, and so an idea I just had was, at the time it was literally, I think it was the only podcast I had ever heard of. It was just a show I listened to every once in a while, Radiolab, and I just cold called them, and I was like, hey. Like I have a whole bunch of stories that I think are awesome, and I think you guys are awesome, and I think, you know, you guys might be interested in them. And I cold called the executive producer of the show. Her name is Ellen Horn. She's a super nice lady, total stranger. I knew nobody in, you know, in any kind of any radio related, like had no contacts, had no context, had no background or right. any idea.
Just going for it.
Just was like, yeah, it's just like I'm a fan of this show. I like it. It has my sensibility. It makes me laugh. It makes me cry. I like it. This woman, Ellen Horn, I just basically like rapid fire. I pitch her a whole bunch of things. She liked them all. I don't remember whether it was on the phone or in an email like very soon after we hung up. She was like, yeah, we're not going to use any of these. Like, thanks, but no thanks. Mm. But you have a great eye. Like, you have some, you know, I've never heard any of these pitches before, that kind of thing.
That's encouraging.
So it was super encouraging. And I was like shocked that even someone in the hallowed halls of this show that I liked so much had like even listened to me and considered my ideas, and that like I wasn't even just like hung up on or laughed at, you know, like right off the bat.
Yeah.
I was just so shocked even that like they were received, you know, these ideas, these story ideas that were so great. Yeah. And then eventually she took one idea. Because I kept sending her, and eventually she took one. And then they took another one, and then they started inviting me to their weekly editorial meetings, and I would just kind of go and hang out. And I still was in grad school by this point, and by that point I was writing my dissertation, which sounds like you are in a similar mode in your post-production thing, where it's like kind of a lonely, weird thing where you're working on this thing and nobody knows what you're doing, but it's like you can't really show them because it's not done yet. So I was working on my dissertation. I didn't know what else to do. So I just hung out. I just like sort of for need of companionship and just people to talk to, I just hung out at their at their office, like all the time. I kind of like haunted that place. And then at some point they were like, oh, like, why are you just here all the time? And then they basically tried to hire me full time. And that's basically what happened. Then I told them to wait. And then I graduated. And then I became the director of research at Radiolab. Long-winded. Sorry.
All right. No, that was awesome.
Aimed for that to be medium long, but then it ended up just being long, long.
That's a great story. How would you characterize what is a Radiolab story?
Yeah. It's a very good question because it used to be one thing and now it's a totally different thing, but I think there's some common things along the way. I think the way I would characterize, let me flip it on you. I'm curious to hear, I have an answer to that, but do you have an answer to that? Not to put you on the spot.
No, yeah, go for it. So I think there are qualities to me that stand out as like, ooh, I could tell that was a Radiolab story. And a lot of that has to do, of course, with like sound design.
Sure.
A lot of it has to do with the pacing of the dialogue. It almost feels like a lot of podcasts I feel like I could listen to on like 1.25 the speed.
Yeah.
And Radiolab kind of feels like it's just already there.
Yeah, right. That's fine.
Like it moves, you know?
Yeah.
And then I would say,
So far and maybe it's because you're in the middle of post-production stuff. So far you're spoken like an editor.
Right. Yes.
Right. But I can tell you sort of from my perspective, which is more like a reporter's perspective.
Yeah,
I don't do the
it.
Yeah. So like even when I cold called and even to some degree today, I mean I've learned some stuff, but I'm mostly not dealing with tape. I'm not cutting tape. I do like I'll maybe do like a first draft of something or what we call a string out, but I'm not the one like making those really pretty musical flourishes or doing that kind of stuff. I'm sort of on the beginning end of it. I report out the stories. I find stories. I report them out. I do interviews. I kind of have storyboard ideas and stuff like that. But getting back to your question. So from a reporter's eye, to me, what a Radiolab story is it's a story. It's like a rip-roaring good story that has, you know, twists and turns and suspense and characters and emotional arcs and things like that. But more so than that, it's a story with either an idea or a question hidden inside of it. It's a story that makes you, by the end, you kind of don't know quite what to think. You don't quite know what to feel. When it's at its best, I think it pulls your head in one direction and your heart in the exact opposite direction. I think that it introduces you to a whole new world or a whole new question that you never even thought of. And now you're going to stay up, you know, at night thinking about. Or it'll make you look at a thing that you thought you knew, an argument you thought you knew, or a point of view of the world that you thought you had, and it'll make you sort of reconsider it, and it'll make you see it in a whole new light. To me, that's kind of my marching orders as someone who goes out and finds Radiolab stories. Those are the things I'm looking for.
Gotcha. And so when you are looking for stories, and I would encourage everyone who's listening to the podcast right now to check out Latif's article on Transom or a recent Radiolab episode where he talks about how he finds stories in some very fun and brilliant ways. So we're not going to go into that, but I'm wondering, As you're going out, besides those kind of like tactical approaches you outline in the Transom article, what types of questions are you asking yourself before you decide I'm going to go spend a ton of time reporting this out? Like, how are you trying to evaluate before you've even like maybe gotten on the ground somewhere?
Yeah, I think one of the big questions that I often ask myself when I find a story or a question for that matter, because sometimes you're looking for the story and sort of the question to be sort of nestled into one another. And either sometimes you find the story first and sometimes you find the question first. Mm-hmm. But either way, I think what I'm usually looking for is like, am I genuinely interested in this? Like, is this a thing that I would, given all the million other things that I could spend my time thinking about or researching or trying to talk to people about, like, is this something that I willingly will devote my brain to? Like, is this something that either is puzzling enough or sort of pleasurable enough, or yeah, like, is there something about this that makes me really wanna think about it harder and to kind of like put myself in the various characters' perspectives or put myself in the various ideological stances and really interrogate from like different angles? Because there's a lot of things, like, especially when you see like in a lot of radio stories or print stories or whatever, like people will have like rhetorical questions.
Yeah.
And then you look at those questions and you're like, I don't really care about the answer to that question. Like, and or alternately, like, that's a question that feels like I'm supposed to ask it. Like, that feels like a homework question as opposed to a real genuine question. That doesn't feel like a question that I naturally would like spring forth out of me, like with the urge of like when you have to pee really bad, like like that feeling where you're like, I can't help but ask this question. I need to ask this question. Like, I maybe shouldn't ask this question. Maybe it's impolite, or maybe it's weird, or maybe it's awkward, or maybe it's whatever, but I like just gotta ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's the thing you want. Like, you don't want the thing where it's like, oh, this is a polite thing that I'm supposed to be interested in because everybody else is telling me to, or yeah, like there are a lot of things that are really important that are actually just not that interesting. And I'm lucky because I know there are a lot of other journalists who cover that stuff. And there are a lot of things that are interesting that are not really that important. And there are a lot of other journalists who cover that stuff. But to me, I'm trying to find stuff that's like important and interesting. And it's like, it just comes out of this wellspring of like, I can't not pay attention to this. Like, yeah. I have to pay attention to this because yeah. it feels like if I don't, I'm going to be wondering about it anyway, you know,
right.
That kind of thing.
You just kind of mentioned the word, like, is it important? And this definitely came out when I was listening in preparation for this interview to your latest piece on Radiolab about the hockey player.
Which,
sure. I was like getting emotional.
Oh man, that one, I know, right?
Oh my gosh.
No.
Obviously, you're not a print hard news reporter who has to like have a kind of a peg
right.
to a news
yeah.
newsworthy thing
yeah.
or
and I'm so lucky for that. Like when I was a historian, when I was a grad student, I didn't just pitch Radiolab, I also pitched all these other places. Like, I would write print stuff, and that was always the hardest part for me. I'd be like, this is an amazing story, but it just doesn't have a news peg. Like, but it's an amazing story, and then people would be like, nah, doesn't work. But anyway, yeah, that was always the hardest part for me, which is I feel like this crazy luxurious it's like an immense luxury for me to be able to tell stories on Radiolab where like people just do, like, news pegs don't matter. Like, it's like, oh, just tell me a good story. Anyway,
so
sorry, I cut off your question.
No, it's all good. So do you, as a storyteller then, whether it's in crafting the script or whenever it is, like, do you have to convince your audience that this is important and worth listening to, or does now like the Radiolab brand just carries that?
No, it definitely does not carry that. People get like, I mean, the Radiolab brand is probably enough to make people start listening, but it's definitely not enough to keep them continuing listening. Like, and I don't think I think very few things are like that, you know?
Okay.
But I think like, yeah, and even if it was, like, you have to act as if it's not, because it's like attention is the most valuable thing. Like, this is, you definitely are jockeying for attention. But the thing is, for me, and this is just maybe something about myself that I've learned, which is that, like, no matter how important a thing is, like, you are not gonna, and it's just like a sad truth, like, you are not gonna command my attention unless it's like, It's more about carrots and less about sticks. Like, it's more about, like, you have to seduce me into paying attention. Don't tell me I have to pay attention because in fact that's going to make me want to pay less attention, like seduce me. And I think that's what we try to do with every one of our stories. Like start with a, like that hockey story, it starts with like a premise that is like an insane premise, which is the premise is these sort of mischievous hockey fan types come up with this idea, which is that what if we voted through fan vote, the worst player in the NHL into the All-Star game, which is like a crazy premise. And it's like just by virtue of that premise, I don't know, for me, even though I don't care about hockey at all, like I want to know what happens. Like what's going to happen? I don't know. Like and it's a like to me that's a really good premise, like cuz you're like, "Oh, wow. Oh, man. Like what's going to happen?" Like and those are the kinds of stories where I'm like, "Okay, I'm in. Like tell me." And that's the kind of way you have to build it so that your that your listener can't not listen to it, you know?
Yeah. So then like when you're out reporting, and we could use that story as an example,
sure.
Or I'm sure the reporting process on your border series was much different.
Totally different. Yeah, sure.
But what are ways that you prepare for an interview? You've asked this question, am I genuinely interested? You're like, yes. Now you're out in the field or now you're on the phone. How are you preparing for an interview? And then maybe if I could layer another question on that is, what makes a good interview?
Yeah. I think it's a, have you ever heard of, this is a thing that I learned when I was in high school taking a theater class. Have you ever heard of the janitor test?
No.
So the janitor test is, let's say you were practicing, you're rehearsing like a monologue or something, right? You're on a stage and you're rehearsing. This is like why I think about it. Like because I was in high school like rehearsing monologues or whatever. And then you'd be doing the monologue and the idea is that what you're talking about should be so interesting and should feel so sort of like exciting that the janitor who's cleaning the next room over should kind of like have to put down the, you know, the broom and just come over to the doorway and be like, what the hell is going on in there? You know, like that's the thing. That's the thing you want. That's a successful interview. But okay, so to answer your first part of your question, what you want, so I prepare a lot for my interviews. I like actually way over prepare usually. And then I like once the thing happens, I throw everything away. But the way that I prepare for interviews is first of all, I just will basically sketch out like, okay, what is the bio of this person that I'm talking to? And, you know, among the other things, like when you think of a bio, like you'd think of, oh, okay, the important things are like basically this person's CV, right? But that's not just it. The other things that are really important that you want to think about when you're writing your interview prep for yourself or for somebody else is A, how long since this has happened? Like, are you talking about something that's happening present tense? Are you talking about something that happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Has this person told this story many times before? Is this a story that is really a very tender, sensitive kind of a story? Is this a story that is a kind of comical, like anecdote, like I didn't even think about it? Or is this a story that's like, oh, I served 30 years in prison because of the thing I'm about to tell you? Is it a story like you kind of have to have a very clear sense. It's almost like I think of, and it's funny because I see this a lot, like all of the people on the Radiolab staff, I've done interviews with so many of them because we often like tag team and do interviews together, and everyone has such different styles. And you realize like depending on A, like sort of the circumstances, who the person is and what their experience is and what kind of experience you're talking to them about, and B, what you want to come out the other end, like what the kind of tape you want, it actually means you have to be a totally different person in that interview. Sometimes you want to be a, and this is my sort of default mode, the like really polite, really sweet listening guy who like doesn't like barely talks and just is like a, like egging you on from the side and like kind of like empathetic, but like mostly not there even, just like letting people just like tell the story. Sometimes you want to be like, really like holding people's nose to the document, you know, like being like, oh, like, but you said this on this day, like that kind of thing, like really hard, being the hard guy, you know. Sometimes you want to be just a chaos agent, like sometimes, and Robert Krulwich of our show is someone who I've seen do this a million times, and he's so good at it. Like, especially if you have like a scientist who's like very circumscribed in what they can talk about, or like someone who's told a story 100 times before and they're so used to telling it and they've told it the same way. And by that point, it's like a kind of a tired tell, like you can tell that someone's told this story so many times. You want someone in the room who just like asks the weirdo dumb question that's like so random that it jolts someone out of their, you know, out of their pattern, so that then they'll like all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is fresh again, like it's that person. Sometimes there's anyway, there's just like all these different styles of interviewing, and you have to know, you kind of have to calibrate, like, okay, which do I want? Like, which is going to be most useful for this particular scenario? One other thing that I do to prep, actually, this is maybe even before you're prepping for the interview, it's when you're casting. Casting is enormously important. So when you're deciding who to interview in the first place, it's so important. That's actually like almost more important than even anything you do in the interview. And part of the reason is because, like for us at Radiolab, we like fetishize, like we will obsess over getting, you want the person to talk in the first person, you want the person to be able to say, I did this and I did that and then this happened to me and I felt that and blah 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 blah. You want to get as close to the core, to the like emotional core of the story, or you want to be talking to someone to whom it happened, which makes doing historical stories like the ones I'm interested in way 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 harder, because often those people are dead and you can't talk to them. But when you can, you wanna be able to go right to the source. Like it's a huge world of difference between talking to the person it happened to and talking to the person who had the apartment next door. It's a totally, totally, totally different story. And so you really want to get the person who, is right at the center. That access, it means a world of difference for any story, any kind of documentary story.
And then I imagine, I think I saw from this hockey piece we're referencing, I think I saw that you posted on Twitter that it took years to get.
Oh, yeah. It took me 3 years of like basically harassing this guy. Yeah. Because for me, like anybody could just tell the story, but hearing the story from his own words of what happened, the highs and the lows, I mean, this is a story with crazy highs and crazy lows, and hearing, you want to hear all that from one person. And it also helped that he happens to be the sweetest guy that you just sort of fall in love with. And hearing that from his perspective, it just like that's what made that whole story is to hear it from his voice. Like otherwise that story would be nowhere near as good as I think it is.
So a couple of guests who I've had on my show who are in the radio world, and I think I first kind of really started to learn about this concept when I read the book Out on the Wire, which is about how radio is made from some of the top shows. Is this idea that you want to illuminate to the audience what this story means about like the universe or the human condition, why this matters to like everyone in the world. And oftentimes in radio, the kind of takeaway message, especially in like something like This American Life, can be like literally said to you by the narrator of the story. I'm wondering if you think about how you think about that in your stories. And since we're talking about the interview, do you try to get the people you're speaking to to make that connection or what?
That thing, that sort of the kind of moral of the story, that's something that I'm thinking about before even I pitch the story. That's like one of the most important ingredients of the story. Is like what does this mean? What's the point of telling this? Like, what does this mean for somebody who's listening who does not care about hockey, who's never cared about hockey, who's never seen a game of hockey? Our editor, our senior editor at the show, he said something. He has this line where he's like, like we should be able to, it's the cheesiest thing. He says like we should be able to, oh no, like the job that we're doing, it's like we are women's shoe salesmen who are trying to sell women's shoes to men who have no legs. Like, and it's like, that's the thing. Like, it's like, you need to be, that's the level of, like, you need to be able to sell it to somebody who is, this is totally antithetical to what they think they want. Like, and so it is, and then granted, and this is, I think we're guilty of this as anybody else, like as much as anybody else, which is that sometimes it's like, I mean, you want to swing for the fences with every story, but you can't always do it. Like, so sometimes it's like, it does feel a little bit tacked on, or it does feel a little bit unearned. Like, it's like, you're like, oh, is that story really about that thing that you just sort of tacked on at the end? But to be fair, like that, like I am, and all my colleagues, like we think about that a lot from the very beginning. And it also, I mean, if you're picking the right kinds of stories, like this story about John Scott, like I think a lot of the stories that I try to do and I try to pick, there's stories where you're like, there's someone at the center who is going through something that nobody else ever on planet Earth has gone through that particular thing. Nobody. Like, nobody has gone through what this guy went through. When I did a story, the other sort of ice skating story I did was about this figure skater, Saria Bonnelly, and she did a move that nobody else has ever done in the history of the world.
I remember trail running listening to that story.
Yeah. And it's such a cool story, right? Like, and it's a backflip onto one blade. But like, anyway, you're trying to find people who have done something that nobody else has ever done, or nobody else has ever felt this very particular cocktail of feelings that they're feeling. And maybe, I mean, like, you know, we all kind of have a sense of what it's like to accomplish something, or we have a sense of, for the hockey player, what it's like for people to make fun of us, or we have a sense of like that kind of thing. But like this particular cocktail of this particular experience, like nobody has been in this exact thing. And so you, one of the things that I think for me, I do find myself curious about, and one of the things I really want to ask when I do talk to people is like, oh my God, what was that like? Like, what was that like to be in that position, that fully unprecedented in human history position? How can you, it's as much for the story and for the listeners as it is for myself. Like, I just want to know, like, what was it like to stand there after you won, you know, this thing, or after you, you know, you worked your whole career to go to the Olympics and then you lost, but then you did this crazy move or whatever it is. Like I think there are, it very much is like that meaning making we talk about it as at the end, where you're like, okay, what does this all mean? Why did I listen to this? Like, it was, I had fun, but am I going to remember this or think about it? Like after I, you know, pull the earbuds out of my ears, like that thing, we definitely are casting for it. Like I ask, like the question I ask often, like it's like after the story is all done, it's like, what does this mean to you? Like, how did this change what you think? Like, how did you, do you keep thinking about this and why? Like, and what makes you, how did this make you see the world differently, or people differently, or the universe differently, or yourself differently, or those kinds of things, you know?
Right. So then after you've done the interviewing, after you've gathered the many hours of tape, what is the editing process at Radiolab to the extent that you're involved?
Do you guys do
table reads? And
no, we don't, but that's funny. I'm so flattered that you think we do. What we do is, okay, so generally what we do is, I'll even take it from the beginning. So first, someone like me or one of the other producers, or even someone outside of the show, will come up with a pitch. They'll email it into one of the producers, and then we'll take it to the pitch meeting. We have this kind of amazing, glorious pitch meeting, which is also can be very critical and savage, but usually is like
is that like once a week?
It's once every 2 weeks now. It used to be once a week, but but where, you know, where no question is, you know, nothing is sacred and anyone can say anything, and it's pretty great. And it's also like just thrilling, intellectually thrilling. And so we have this pitch meeting and it's awesome. And then if we want to go forward with the story, we kind of come up with next steps and we say, okay, let's interview this person first. And then if that's good, we'll go blah, 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 blah. And then we do a bunch of interviews. After the interviews, we do a thing called cutting selects. So we will boil down. Usually we do like 90-minute interviews, super long interviews. Usually we'll boil those down to about 15 minutes of the best, hottest tape. And then we will, from there, once we have sort of enough of those that we feel like, oh, that I feel like we could tell the story with that, we all listen to the tape together, or all the selects together, or like whoever's working on that episode. And then we do a storyboard meeting. So we'll like, first we'll get in, we'll be like, oh my God, I love that moment about this. And like, oh yeah, me too. No, no, no. But I definitely didn't believe when this person was saying that thing. Oh yeah, but wouldn't it be interesting to splice that with this other thing or whatever? So we just kind of like fantasize.
And you might have like 2-3 people doing that, or is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's like, yeah, usually it's a small group, including our, like it'll probably be the reporter, like me, maybe a producer or two, depending on who's on that story, or probably a senior editor Soren Wheeler, maybe Jad and or Robert, our two hosts, maybe one or two other people, and also could be our director of sound design, Dylan Keefe, or like other people who would be working on the music for that episode. So it's kind of a lot of different people with a lot of different brains who are coming to the story with a lot of varying levels of sort of knowledge of it. And then what we do is we sort of say, okay, what would be the best way to tell this? Like, what would be the most, you know, seductive, interesting, weird, like, and we just kind of puzzle it out and we're like, okay, we'll introduce this person. We'll start here. We'll introduce this person here. Then we'll go, then right as that person is about to say this, we're going to actually introduce this person. And then we'll do that thing. And then right before that, we'll go to break. And then we'll come back from break.
Are you putting up like Post-it notes? Are you sketching this out on a whiteboard?
Usually we have a Google Doc like in front of us, all of us, we'll sort of like be doing things. And then sometimes multiple of us are in it, or we're copy pasting things all over the place, or sometimes it's just like, gotcha. We're just talking it out. Like we'll just talk it out like 10 times. And we also do things like even before this, like what we call like mood boards and stuff sometimes, where it'll be like, okay, I want this first scene. Like I remember wanting the first scene of the I had an idea. We didn't end up doing it, but I had this idea when we were doing the Border Trilogy where I was like, oh, I want the first scene of the Border Trilogy to feel like the first scene of Breaking Bad, where you're like in this place and there's this like that we're in the desert and there's this crazy van going out in the middle of nowhere. And ours, I wanted to start, I remember initially in the storyboard, if you've heard the story or not, but like there's this anthropologist and he's sitting, you know, in a truck, in the passenger seat of a pickup truck. And these people that are like driving out in the middle of the desert, and then they go back, they get somewhere, they open the back of the truck, and then they pull out these pigs, and then they're live pigs, and then they have to shoot them in the head. And it's just like this just weird, and then they shoot them in the head, and then they dress them in human clothing. And I had this like vision where I was like, oh, it's so gruesome and weird. Like, it feels like the opening to Breaking Bad, where you're like in the middle of nowhere. Like, what is going on? Anyway, so that's another thing we do sometimes, is be like, oh, this is just like this movie, or this is just like, I want it to feel like this song, or I want it to feel like this painting, or I want to feel like we do a lot of that. So then we do the storyboard. Storyboard, it's usually like a lather, rinse, repeat kind of thing, where we'll do the storyboard and be like, oh man, we totally didn't realize there's this enormous hole at the middle of the thing. We now need to go back and report and get a whole bunch of new voices on this other thing, or this, that, the other thing. So then we'll do that. You know, it'll go in a circle a few times. And then ultimately, we get back to the storyboard. Once we feel like it's actually starting to be good, we do a thing called string out, which is that you just use clips from, often from the selects, but sometimes from the raw audio too. You just string it all out without any narration. It's just like just the voices. And so you just sort of string it out and no music, no narration, nothing, just the voices.
You're playing the audio clips though. This is not a transcription.
No, it's not a transcription. And it's not okay. Even playing the audio. Like, we'll just, I'll go into Pro Tools, which is the program editing program we use, and I'll just like slot them all next to one another.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then, I neglected to say, once we kind of have a sense of, this is the way we want to tell this story, what we'll do is usually we'll have one person on staff who knows nothing about the story.
Interesting.
Who just is like completely naive to it and doesn't know anything. And what we do is we go into a studio with that person. So let's say it's, in this case, like, let's say it's like Robert Krulwich or something, right? So I'll go into a studio with Robert Krulwich, or I'll go into a studio with, just somebody on staff, and then I'll just tell the story. I'll tell the story in basically the way that we have sketched out, that we know is like a really good way to tell the story. And we'll let both Robert have very natural human questions and responses that in a way are a lot of times are like a proxy for the listener. Teach us like, oh, this is a moment that's a really kind of sensitive little ankle joint, you know, for this story that doesn't make sense or whatever. So we'll sort of do that. And then also what's good is it's good for me because I'm now tracking narration in a way, though, that is not out of a can. You know, it's not like I'm reading a line. I'll just go into
right.
the studio and I'm just telling them the story. Like I'm telling a story to a friend at a diner or something, you know?
So no script. Yeah.
No script.
Right.
And I tend to like, I'll look over all my stuff so that I'm not factually way off base or anything. But yeah, but it's no script. And then what we do is that, so we do that, and then what we do is we take that string out, and we take what's called the brain dump, which is that thing where I'm just telling the story, and then we sort of try to layer those two on top of one another. So you use the narration, and you use the interviews, and you're kind of dipping in and out of each one, and from there, we also start to add music, and from there, so after the string out is basically, for me, production-wise, where I hand it off, because we have so many other producers who are so much more talented, in terms of like production. So there is where I stop sort of editing the tape, and you'll have to talk to one of them to kind of get more nitty gritty about. But like we go through tons of drafts, and every draft I will give feedback for, or, you know, a whole bunch of different people will give feedback for. And we'll also like, again, one of the things like I was saying earlier, like we control the information pretty. So there are always going to be people who are hearing it for the first time or who don't really haven't been paying attention to the story for a while. So they have kind of fresh ears. And so it's like, okay, play it for these people. Okay, we got this feedback. Okay, now try to fix that. Now play it for a whole new batch of people and kind of keeping doing that, like keeping it fresh. And sometimes it means like playing it for friends of ours who are not at the show, but just like are, you know, have a fresh ear, or people who are like experts in this field who feel like, oh, they're especially sensitive and attuned and they'll know what, you know, what's the sort of sensitive spot or if we're explaining something wrong or whatever.
And what's like a normal timeline for all of this to happen?
Yeah, it takes forever. Like our the fastest I've seen a Radiolab story happen is probably in like 2 or 3 weeks. Or actually, that's okay. Not fair. We've definitely done like overnight kind of stories or like 1 week stories, but that was like especially unusual, and we didn't use our normal process. But for this normal process,
right.
It's usually like 3 weeks is the shortest I've ever seen it. Like basically a year or two or three is like the longest I've ever seen it.
Okay.
Yeah, and oftentimes that time when it stretches that long, it's usually like I'm waiting on someone to talk to me or I need a scene tape or something like that. But it does take a very long time, and we go through dozens of drafts, dozens and dozens of drafts, like so many drafts. Like you'll see something and it'll be like, okay, this is draft 47 of this. And you're like, oh my God, how have we made so many drafts? And it also will bounce back and forth. So it's like, so my colleague Matt will have the draft, and then at some point he'll hand it off to my colleague Annie, and then Annie will have the draft and she'll hand it off to my colleague Bethel or whoever, whatever it is, whatever the order is. Like it bounces around a lot. So it's actually a very, very deeply collaborative thing, which is great.
And on, and so on that note of collaboration, I mean, I've never heard of a program or kind of an editing system or reporting system that kind of works in this way. I mean, it is intensely collaborative.
Yeah, yeah.
And what qualities do you think that provides the end product story that's unique?
Yeah. It's a funny, like what personal qualities or what story like editing or reporting qualities? Yeah.
The fact that it's so collaborative, the fact that you probably get to the end of the story and not know like, wow, did I write that or did he write that or where did that come from? Like, what does that provide the story that's valuable?
Yeah, the way that it gets to be that way, I think like everybody on staff is very, very creative and like willing to sort of sublimate their sort of creative instincts and to sort of a larger piece, which is like kind of awesome. Like where it's very much a team sport for us. So like I'm gonna try my hardest, even though this isn't one of my reported stories. Like I'm gonna try my hardest to like make this the best it could possibly be. And then similarly though, even if it's my story and then I am sort of I have to be able to articulate very specifically why I dislike something or why I really love it. And if I dislike something and I'm completely outgunned, like everybody else thinks that I'm an idiot and I'm crazy, which happens often, I will step down or I will like really go to the mat, but I'll go to the mat like I don't go to the mat very often. And when I go to the mat, like I will really have a articulable reason for it, you know? And basically I think everybody's basically like that. Like we're not precious. We're not sensitive. We don't take it personally. And it's, even though it's very, like you're putting so much of your personality into a draft. You still can't, like, you can't take it personally because it's so like things get chopped out all the time. Like we'll get to the 11th hour and all of a sudden a chapter is just omitted or it's like completely redone or it's like, you know, things happen like that all the time.
Yeah, man, that sentiment of like not being so, like not getting your ego tied to drafts and not being so precious about
hard.
Things is like, it's hard, but it's so valuable in creative work. I'm wondering. Yeah.
It's also, one quick last thing, which is that it's also like the ability, I think so much of what we do, because we have so many drafts, because we have so many different people working on it, it's the ability to hear something fresh, like to hear something that you've already in your mind has been played out so many, like 100 times that this one way, and then you hear it this other way, and to be able to be like, okay, let me just put these two things side by side, and actually, that thing's better. Like that one's better than mine. And to be able to hear that or to be able to equally say, nah, you know what? I think mine's better. Or I think the way we had it before is better. Like that's an immensely valuable skill. Like hearing something for the first time is like the ability to do that is, I'm able to do it somewhat. There are other of my colleagues who are able to do it more than me, and it's a superpower. It's totally a superpower. Mm-hmm.
What is one of the most meaningful lessons that JAD has taught you?
There's so many.
It doesn't have to be the most meaningful. One that is meaningful.
One that is meaningful. I mean, actually, off. I think I really credit to him the thing that I was saying before where it's like just go deep inside yourself and ask, like, do I really care about this? Like, do I really care? And why do I really care? And like, do I care because I'm supposed to care, or do I care because I actually care? And what is the sort of real nugget of my interest here? And like, how do I get as close to that as I possibly can? I feel like that's the thing that I've learned from him, seeing him over and over. Like, I will often see pitched, or even pitch myself, stories that I'm like, okay, I think there's something here. And he'll be like, is it, like, are you really interested in this? Like, is this question really something that keeps you up in the middle of the night? Like, really? And it'll make me, it, like, he just makes you think deep. Like, is this something I'm actually curious about? Or is this something that, yeah, is this like I'm like performing this curiosity? Like, I think that I, yeah, I'm supposed to. I don't know how to articulate it any better than that. But I think that he's someone who I've seen do that a million times, and he'll be like, yeah, actually, I'm not interested in this. And we'll actually have gone so long. We've done so much reporting or producing on a story, and I'm like, you know what? Actually, like, I don't think this is going to work. Like, I don't actually like this thing. And it can be very frustrating, but it can be like, he'll articulate to you. He'll be like, here's why this isn't that interesting to me. Because this thing and this thing and this thing, and this person didn't do this thing. And if this person had said that thing, that would have been really interesting. But actually, this person just said that thing, or whatever it is, right? And you're like, you know what? You're kind of right. And I'm forcing it. Like, I'm forcing it. And it's, if it's something forced, it's going to feel forced. And you have to kind of let, it's such a hard job, because you have to catch lightning in a bottle every time. But then sometimes he'll be like, oh, this lightning, it's not so lightning-y, you know? And you'll be like, right. Like, and I don't want to acknowledge that you're right, but you're totally right. And you have to kind of, and again, it goes back to that seeing something fresh for the first time, even though you're seeing it for the 90th time. Like, I think he's really taught me to go deep inside myself and actually find the part of this that is like the thing of myself, or the thing of humanity that I can find in this particular story, you know?
Right. Yeah. In this article, which I mentioned earlier in our conversation that you wrote on Transom.
Yeah.
You talked about the thing you love about being a journalist is that it turns the world into the world's biggest scavenger hunt. And I just love this idea. And it's one of the things that when I'm reflecting about like what I'm grateful for, this comes to mind. It really resonates with me, because I feel like the world really glistens when I get to do my job as a journalist and be out there looking for stories and searching. And I'm wondering, you know, that's kind of my little reflection on it, but I'd love to hear a little bit more from you about what you meant by this and what that means to you to approach the world as if you're in the world's largest or biggest scavenger hunt.
Yeah. I'm grateful for that too. Like, I think that it's finding stories has never been my... I have tons of problems and tons of things that I suck at, but finding stories has never been one of them. And I so often find people who come and ask me, they're like, oh my God, how do you find stories? Like, I'm tapped out. I'm stuck. Like, I have no idea. I need a story and I can't find one. That kind of feeling. And for me, it's like, it has taken me a while to sort of articulate it, that idea of the scavenger hunt, because it's like, oh, wait a second. Like, I think it's a first principles thing. Like, you just have to kind of step back for a second and see that, like, you just have to kind of acknowledge, like, the world is an interesting place. There's like dynamic, exciting things happening every single minute, everywhere, to all kinds of people, people you know and people you don't know, to dead people, to alive people, even to fictional people. There are just like stories happening everywhere, to animals and insects and corporations and planets and, abstract legal concepts or like whatever. There's so many, like when you think about it, for a second and you sort of step back and you realize like there's an infinity of stories. There's an infinity of stories out there, and what we get to do, and it's like it's really a privilege, like I think it's we get to sort of find the stories that are out there that are most exciting, that are most obscure, and we get to sort of trumpet them to the world, to be like, oh my God, look at this amazing thing that I didn't even make up, that it's so good that I couldn't have made it up. And I didn't even have to make it up because it's right here. Like, check it out. And that's, I think, like, that's the whole job. Like, and sometimes it's interesting. There's so many flavors of interesting. There's beautiful, and there's horrifying, and there's surprising, and there is puzzling, and there is ethically fraught. And there is, you know, there's all these flavors of interesting. But in general, it's like, wow, like this is here. Look at this. Like, and I bet you, if you're anything like me, like you will not be able to stop thinking about this thing because it's so, it just grabs you the way it grabs me. And I think for me, the fun is like going out and collecting things, especially that nobody else is looking at, and that, you know, seem really mundane, really quotidian, really just boring, and finding stuff that you're like, wow, like this is actually, there's something hidden in here, that sparkles, that like that will, like to me that's the job, and what you realize when you sort of approach the world that way, is that the job becomes a lot easier, like. When you want to know, when you're sort of genuinely curious about the world and you find that, you sort of commune with yourself and you find that genuine curiosity about the world, all of a sudden stories are everywhere. They just pop up all over the place. And when you know, it's about kind of going into weird places and looking in weird places. It's about like knowing how to recognize a story that would make a good story, or that, you know, has unanswered questions that you still want to get to the bottom of, or you know, that trying to find out how to get access to it or whatever. But like, but in general, like to me, that's a huge part of the mission, a huge part of the job. It's just about, like, it's an attitude shift. It's not, oh my God, I need a story. Mm-hmm. I'm tapped out. I'm so stressed out. How do I find a story? It's like, oh, like this world, right? Like it's like that, right? And you're like, oh my God, what a world this is. And like you look around and then you'll find stuff, and stuff will just like bubble up, and you're like, oh my God, how is this not a thing that everybody's talking about? Because it's so, it's like, yeah, you couldn't make it up.
Okay, before we find out where to find you, and my last question, I wanted to try a little new segment of the show called Gear Corner real quick.
Great. 'Cause
people are always interested in gear.
In gear, yeah, sure.
Yes. You mentioned that software you use is Pro Tools.
Pro Tools.
Can we hear a little bit more?
I hate Pro Tools. I very unwillingly use Pro Tools. Pro Tools basically is the very, like to me, as far as I can tell, it's like kind of the, you know, very high-end European luxury sports car that's like super sensitive. It's like this thing that in the hands of experts who know what they're doing and like driving, it is a master tool. Like it is like the, it is, it, you can do a million things that you can't do with anything else. I am a dumb caveman. Like I do not know how to do half the stuff. 90% of the stuff on Pro Tools, like I 90% of the features, I don't even use them. I'm just like doing the very, very like, basically the analog thing that you would be doing, which is like cutting and pasting tape. So for me, I hate this program because it's so overwhelmingly complicated, but a lot of people love it. So, but and anyways, I kind of am locked into using it. That's one of the other collaborative things. You have to use the same programs as everybody else. But yeah, but so for experts, I would highly recommend Pro Tools. For non-experts, I would not.
Okay. Do you have a recommendation?
I don't, because this is all I use, okay. even though I dislike it so much. But it's like it's good. Right. It's really good. Like, it does the thing that it needs to do, but it's way overwhelmingly complicated.
What about mic and recorder? What are you using these days?
Mic and recorder. To be honest, I am so dumb about stuff like that. So my mic and recorder, like sound designer kind of basically helped me set up my studio in my garage here. So I like couldn't even tell you what this thing is that I'm talking into right now.
Okay.
That's how dumb and naive I am about audio. But I can tell you that the thing that I use to do like field recordings is it's like a pretty dinky thing, actually. It's just a, it's like a Zoom. I want to say, hold on, it's here somewhere. Where is it? Here. It is a Zoom H1 handy recorder. It's the tiniest, dinkiest thing. And it's I think it was like probably like it was less than $100, I think. So I use that with just like a pair of headphones, and I just go, I am so bad and dumb at stuff like gear, but it somehow works out. Like, once you have like a baseline of knowledge about how to use these things, like to me, I'm not that much interested in learning more. I'm like way more interested in the story and the craft of story.
For sure.
And all the technical stuff, I'm like, I find it super overwhelming, and I kind of stay away from, cause I'm like a Luddite technophobe kind of a person. But the best place to look for that stuff, if you actually want the real skinny on that stuff, is probably Transom. They probably have all the gear stuff for any, at least for audio people. They have all the gear you could possibly want.
Cool. All right. Before my last question, Latif,
sure.
If people want to follow you, your work, where should we send them?
You could probably just follow me on Twitter. Like, I tweet about the stories that I do. Vast majority of them I do for Radiolab, but I have other stuff that I have done and continue to do outside of the show. So they can just follow me on Twitter, or yeah, that's probably the best way to do it, at Latif Nasser. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. And I will put a link to that in the show notes, everybody.
Thank you kindly.
Yeah, well, of course. All right, my last question. So, based on all your experience at Radiolab, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are telling stories in all different sorts of genres. You know, we have filmmakers, photographers, actors. And the great thing about this is that so many of these lessons that we're talking about today are, you know, they cross the boundaries of each of these genres, and they really blend into each other.
Yeah.
So based on all of your experience, I'm wondering what either lesson or storytelling strategy or something to think about would you want to impart on all of us who are striving to become better storytellers?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I do really think, and especially, I mean, if you didn't already discern that from my answer about the like radio equipment, like I think it's all the same. It's like, it's so much all the same stuff. Like, there are so many other people who work in audio or whatever who really, like, they grew up listening to, you know, public radio, or they think that, you know, podcasts are like this really niche and specific and special medium, and no knock to those people, but I think it's all the same stuff. Like, whether you're watching a movie, or whether you're watching whether you're reading a comic book, or whether you're reading whatever, like, to me, it's all the same stuff. And I think that it's actually, to me, the things that I've learned that are the most helpful have been kind of the narrative structure stuff I learned as a playwright, like in undergrad. Like, I think that it's like, you want to have a, you know, a character you're tracking. You want to have tension. You want to have obstacles. You want to have, you know, like it's sort of very simple stuff. Like you want to have someone kind of learn something or change over the course of the story. You want to have, yeah, not necessarily good guys and bad guys, because maybe you want to be able to root for them, but you want to use a lot of those sort of like narrative tropes where you're like, yeah, this works like for a reason, like, and it works because these are the, yeah, these kind of story techniques, they are powerful. They're really powerful, and they're kind of human scale, you know? And so even if you're telling the biggest, most ambitious story, or the tiniest, you know, story about some little microscopic single cell creature, it's the same thing, you know? It's all these same things. It's like these narrative tricks that you can kind of use. Like you want to have a character, you want to have tension, you want to have kind of a journey, and you want to have some kind of like a beginning, middle, and then an end, like a resolution. And it's like, it's like the dumbest, simplest advice that is like, you know, you've probably gotten a million other times from a million other people, but I think it's all the same. It's all the same stuff, no matter what you're doing. It's like, these are the same tricks that actually will help you no matter what. And they're not rules. Like, you can break them, but they're really helpful. Like, they're really, really helpful. Like, they're little jetpacks, you know? Like, it's like, okay, why wouldn't you use them? Like, just use them. And maybe there are times you don't want to use them, but they're very, very handy and helpful. And it's like, to me, it's just like, learn about narrative structure, learn about how, like, what shape is your story? What kind of a story is this? Who should I be rooting for at this certain moment? Or what should I feel nervous about? Or why would I be paying attention at this moment? Like, it's like, look for those. I mean, it's the same thing. If you were writing, going back to my kid, like, I'm reading these like children's storybooks. Like, I'm like, oh, it's the same thing. Like, I can see the exact same thing happening here. Yeah, so it's like we're probably doing that at Radiolab and a lot of other places, I'm sure, like, are doing that on steroids. But it's like, yeah, it's the same stuff.
Yeah, it's the fundamentals of storytelling.
Yeah, and it's such a lame answer. Like, I wish that I had some like really new sparkly thing, but it's like, nah, this stuff works. Like, it's pretty good.
This stuff works, and once you get that, like as you're saying, once you develop a grasp of those fundamentals, then you have immense freedom to bend the rules and improvise within that structure, and that's where some of the beauty comes.
Yeah, I really think so. I think that's so true. I think that's really, really true.
All right. Well, I think that's it.
Okay, great.
Yeah, that was great. And to all of the listeners, thank you for tuning in. And go check out Latif on Twitter and say hello. All right.
Thanks for having me, Austin. It's a pleasure to talk. And it's really, it's exciting. I'm excited for your movie.
All right. Wow. That was a treat. I have so much respect for Latif Nasser and everyone over on the Radiolab team. The care and attention to detail that they put into the shows they create, it's just inspiring. And that editorial process, so cool. I feel like going to one of their pitch meetings would be an absolute masterclass. I'd pay good money for a ticket to that show. All right, thanks again to Latif Nasser for joining the show today. Go follow him on Twitter at Latif Nasser and let him know what resonated with you from today's conversation. And wherever you are listening to this podcast right now, go subscribe to Radiolab if you haven't already. It's, as you can tell, I'm a big fan. Our theme music today is by Opus Orange, and today's show was also brought to you by my new Patreon page. Yes, we are officially launched on Patreon. Patreon is a monthly subscription platform where you can give as little as $1 a month to help support the show and also my documentary film work. And in return, you will get some sweet perks on the back end, like the opportunity to ask my guests, like Latif, questions that you have. So head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms to check that out. All right, that's it from here. I will see you next week. Now go out and tell some stories.